This is Rosemary Scalissa for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the coronavirus update, followed by USA Today at 2.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
Sherwood Church of Christ, 4900 North Dixie Boulevard, offers free clothing on the first Saturday of every month. With so many families in the community are losing their jobs due to COVID and the downturn in oil, the Sherwood Clothes Closet is an opportunity for people to find needed clothing items for the entire family. Hours are 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 10 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper single digits. Then tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the upper 30s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Friday, February 12th, 2021. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. One note, I will be taking off most of Thursday and all of Friday. So our reports this Thursday and Friday will be pre-recorded reports from the Texas Standard and a few reports from NPR. One thing I do want to note is that as of Thursday morning at 10 a.m., the CVS pharmacies in Texas are now accepting appointments. The website is very busy, so you may have to wait a while. For updates and information, as well as to book an appointment, you can visit CVS.com. You can use the CVS pharmacy app, or you can call CVS at 800-746-7287. Once again, that number is 800-746-7287. Looking at the status of the CVS website insofar as which cities are fully booked and which are available, the good news is most of the cities in West Texas at 10 a.m. on Thursday, February 11th, are still available for booking. That includes Midland, Odessa, Lubbock, Abilene, and San Angelo. We will return with our regular format for this program on Monday. Now, here are our pre-recorded reports.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. We've done a lot of reporting lately on the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines in Texas, and we've heard mostly from officials and journalists across the state about what's working and what's not. But when we took to the Texas Standard Facebook page recently to ask how the process was actually going for listeners, we really saw just how much of a range of experiences there are. Texas Standard's Laura Rice is trying to track some of those experiences in a new project.
We sent a call out for your COVID-19 vaccine stories, and some of you responded.
Hello, my name is Doug Ramey, and I am 60 years old, and I live west of Fort Worth, Texas. I am a frontline healthcare provider. I have been doing this my whole adult life. The first 10 years as in EMS as an EMT and a paramedic. And then for the last 26 years as a certified registered nurse anesthetist.
That means Ramey is an airway expert, and he knows about the devastation COVID-19 can cause. As a healthcare worker, he should be at the front of the line in Texas. And he says he was.
Through a link, I was able to find the local HEB pharmacy, not very far from our house, and I called them on Christmas Eve and made an appointment for the 26th.
Easy as that. And then for his second vaccine, he got a text to schedule and then a follow-up call for an appointment that same week.
So that process went very well and smoothly, and I'm pleased with how it worked, and I would hope that something similar would be set up for the general population.
But it has not at all been so easy for everyone.
My name is Edwina Bakey. I'm 77 years old. I'm a widow living by myself in San Marcos, Texas. I have high blood pressure, asthma, arthritis. I'm also on a waiting list at my primary care doctor's office, and I've registered at San Marcos Health Department. I check drugstore sites daily on the internet. I also check CVS, Walgreens, HEB, my hospital here in town. I'm frustrated, and I'm worried I won't get vaccinated as soon as possible.
Across the state in El Paso, 40-year-old Jamie Baird has similar concerns.
I have allergic asthma, and I take more than one controller medication, which includes an injectable twice a month. I want the vaccine as I fear that if I were to contract COVID-19, that it would be fatal. I've registered with my county and primary care physician, but the process is just too slow. El Pasoans are hearing that second doses won't be administered until March, while many El Pasoans haven't even received a first dose. My personal skepticism really tells me that for myself and the others in my community, we will not get a first dose until July, given the lack of available vaccines, but I really hope I'm wrong.
In Austin, 67-year-old cancer survivor Tom Phillips also feels this frustration.
And I went to the austintexas.gov login page and signed up and tried to register, and it tells me that there's no vaccines available at this time and won't let me even sign up. And I've done this for several days, and every day, of course, it says there's nothing available and it won't even let me get on a list.
He's considering a workaround.
I was talking to my brother up in Denton, and he said, oh yeah, we can sign up, and then when there's one available, it sends you a text message. So I just went and signed up for the Denton County website. It took me like minutes. It was not confusing at all. And I'm going to just drive up to Denton to get a shot, because the Austin-Travis County website is a joke.
He has mixed feelings about the whole process and how it's being handled in different parts of Texas.
I'm pretty frustrated to have to drive 250 miles to get a shot, but I'm going to do that because now I know I'm on a list. I just got a text message on my phone saying I'm on the list. Pretty cool. Just trying to get this shot to make sure that I don't get hit hard. We have several people I know have gotten it, and some people's parents have passed away, so I think it is important everybody get vaccinated. Thanks a lot.
We want to keep this project going, but we need your stories to do so. If you're currently eligible to get a COVID-19 vaccine in Texas, how's your experience been? You can record your story directly for the radio by going to texasstandard.org/vaccinatingtexas. I'm Laura Rice for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard.
Whether it's about the virus or the vaccine, we want to find answers to your questions about COVID-19. Throughout the pandemic, we've been collecting your questions and bouncing them off Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and an associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard, and Happy New Year to you, sir.
Well, Happy New Year to you too, Dave.
The first question that we have for you comes from listener Katie Fisher. She has a question about the vaccine rollout in Texas. Katie asks, will Texas preschool teachers be eligible for the vaccine at the same time as other teachers? What do you know about that?
Well, I know that there is some uncertainty about how states will prioritize their vaccine candidates, but so far, Texas, for instance, seems to be following the CDC recommendations, and their panel has made recommendations that prioritize teachers, school workers, and child care workers. And so it sounds to me as if this listener is likely to be included in that priority group.
I see. Well, now we've been hearing quite a bit about this new strain of COVID-19 from the UK that's apparently more infectious than the version that we've been dealing with so far here in Texas. And as we've reported here, just last week, the first case of this new strain was found in Harris County. So are there any additional or different precautions you think Texans might need to take in order to stay safe from this new strain of COVID?
Well, you are correct that it appears that the newer strains have mutated and are more infectious, in other words, more likely to to spread better and faster. However, that means that the usual good common sense measures, such as social distancing, masking, hand washing, all the things we've been talking about, are going to be even more important to continue. Of course, vaccination is also effective against these strains at the present time. There have been studies to confirm that. So vaccination with our currently available vaccines, again, are an excellent way to minimize spread.
So I guess the message, as I hear you, Doctor, is don't just keep it up, but maybe step it up.
Absolutely. The sooner we get to herd immunity point, the more likely we are to be able to return to something like a normal activity. And the best way to avoid serious complications, of course, is social distancing, masking, and then vaccination.
One of the things about vaccines, and in particular the COVID vaccine, is the great deal of disinformation that has been out there on social media and the internet more generally. And we received a few questions, Doctor, about possible links between the vaccine and infertility. Is there any data that you're aware of to suggest that this COVID vaccine might cause someone to become infertile or perhaps to have complications with pregnancy?
Well, I am not a specialist in obstetrics and gynecology, but having said that, the news seems to be very good about infertility. There has been no evidence of infertility problems. Of course, it may take a considerable period of time to be certain about that.
And more specifically, what about pregnancy, Doctor?
Again, it is very important that women in childbearing years consult their own personal practitioner about the vaccine, but the news so far has been good, and the vaccine has not apparently caused any serious complications in pregnancy.
Best thing to do, though, talk to your personal practitioner about this.
Absolutely.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio, and he's been joining us regularly over the course of this pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask the doctor about the virus or the vaccine, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus, and you'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again, and thanks again for your expertise.
Thank you. It's great to be of help.
You're on Texas Standard Time.
Throughout the pandemic, rural communities in the Panhandle have been hit particularly hard by the coronavirus. Early on, they faced limited testing supplies and personal protective equipment. Then, last fall, many hospitals ran out of hospital beds. Now, they can't seem to get vaccines into arms fast enough. Texas Tech Public Media's Jamie Lozano follows one man's journey to a vaccine.
Let me call. Let's see what it'll tell me. Let me see. When was it I called? Yesterday. I know I called yesterday. I was trying to get in for a second appointment.
Manuel Mendez calls the Lubbock Health Department to check on his second dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. It's still too soon for him to book his next appointment, but he needs to start making calls now.
All first-dose COVID-19 vaccine appointments for the week of January 25th are now full. The city is working with the state of Texas and the Texas...
Although his age doesn't qualify him for a shot, he's 58, he has diabetes, high blood pressure, and coronary heart disease, which does qualify him.
I'm just trying to protect me, and especially Mom. You know, I mean, I live here with her. I'll be moving out in June, Lord willing.
Open heart surgery left him unable to work, so he lives with his mom. His health conditions, combined with his mom's age, she's 80, makes him anxious to get his final vaccination. Also, his mom refuses to get her shot. He hasn't found a place to get vaccinated in Loveland, so he makes calls to Lubbock, the area's medical hub. But that has also been a struggle.
Why they're using Selectacy, I have no idea. I really don't, because it sucks. You try to get in there, and it throws you somewhere else, and it wants you to buy tickets for basketball. Come on, really? So I got lucky, and I just kept calling and calling and calling, and I got in.
Manuel is one of few residents in Loveland to receive a shot. According to state data, as of January 29th, Little more than 250 Hockley County residents, which includes Leveland, have been fully vaccinated out of a population of 23,000. And most vaccines, according to health officials, have been administered outside of Leveland, in Lubbock. A few days ago, when he finally landed an appointment, Manuel drove 25 minutes to Lubbock Civic Center, where dozens of people stood in line for a vaccine.
You don't have to stand in line, you can just go to your left if you have an appointment.
For many, this is their best and really only option.
I think the frustration for the rural areas is that we don't have any idea as to when we'll be allocated vaccine or how much.
Back in Leveland, Bruce White, CEO of Covenant Hospital, says the facility has received 200 doses of the Moderna vaccine, but he doesn't know when another shipment might come in.
You know, we just don't know when we're going to get it. We kind of sit on our hands. There are several rural hospitals that have yet to receive any vaccine. It's hard to really understand the state strategy on how they're rolling it out. You know, I know there's obviously not about enough vaccine to go out all at once, and so it is what it is.
Data from the APM Research Lab ranks Texas as 30th among all states in immunizing its population, with just 5.2% vaccinated as of January 24th. White said there are plans for a mass vaccination event in Leveland if they ever receive enough doses to pull it off.
We have lots and lots of people, you know, calling for the vaccine, and how do we do this, and how do we get signed up, and that kind of thing. And, you know, the answer right now is advocate for yourself. Get the vaccine where you can get it.
That means getting on the phone like your life depends on it. I'm Jamie Lozano in Leveland, Texas.
This is the first story in a year-long collaboration with Frontline, the PBS series, through its local journalism initiative.
33 minutes past the hour. It's Texas Standard Time, and I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. The Dell Medical School at UT Austin has been testing out a program that could help combat the health effects of loneliness and isolation, particularly among older people. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports public health officials say loneliness has become a growing public health concern that is more urgent during the pandemic.
Didi Diaz is calling up a man named Earl. He's in his late 70s.
Hi, Earl.
Yes.
Hi, Earl. This is Dee Dee.
Yeah, Dee Dee. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, doing pretty good.
Dee Dee and Earl haven't talked in a bit, so there's a lot to catch up on. One of Earl's granddaughters recently got married. Another granddaughter had a baby. It came a little early, he says. He also talked about a small medical procedure he had recently. It went well. The conversation then turns to weather. It's getting colder, so the leaves from the trees around his yard are starting to fall. Earl tells Dee Dee about that, too.
I've got an ash tree in front, so I've been dealing with it.
Okay.
And then the neighbor's key, the backyard, the neighbor's trees, they blow in my yard.
This call is like any other conversation you hear between friends, except it's a little more one-sided. It's mostly about Earl. It's about what has happened in his life, what he's thinking about, what his days are like, including the most mundane details. Dee Dee started these calls with Earl as a volunteer for the Sunshine Calls program. This program serves older adults who are often homebound and therefore pretty isolated in their daily lives. How often they get a phone call varies depending on the person. And the point of the calls is to get these individuals to just talk about themselves.
The focus is really about making the person on the other end feel that it is a time of their own, that it is a time of their priorities, their choices, their interests.
That's Minnie Callon. She's the executive director of Factor Health at Dell Medical School, which is a lead in this project. She says the program uses empathy as a sort of medical intervention for people facing loneliness and isolation. Callon says these simple conversations can eventually, hopefully, have a big effect on how people feel about their own lives.
And in that way, make them feel for that moment, and hopefully it carries forward, that their past matters, their present matters, and what they feel about the future matters.
This project is a partnership between Dell Med and Meals on Wheels of Central Texas. Meals on Wheels is a national group that distributes meals to older Americans. Adam Hauser is the president and CEO of Central Texas's chapter. He says isolation has been an issue among the people they serve for a long time.
It's not uncommon for many of our clients, if they didn't have a daily visit from Meals on Wheels volunteer, they wouldn't see anyone else.
Hauser says isolation and the depression and anxiety that can be caused by isolation has been a public health concern for a while now. But he says the pandemic has been like sort of an x-ray on this problem. Hauser says everyone can just see it a little clearer now.
I guess you could say this is one of the sort of good things to come out of the pandemic, is that people are starting to realize that older adults have very complex and significant needs.
And Minnie Callon with DelMed says these needs have become greater and more urgent during the pandemic. So far, the program has already served more than 100 people.
There's absolutely no question that with COVID and the increased isolation of folks, the interest in loneliness has ratcheted up. No question about it.
Callon says that's why DelMed also began conducting a study on the program. Researchers checked in with people between July and September of last year. They measured whether these sunshine calls had made them feel less isolated, less left out, and like they had companionship in their life. Callon says if they can prove these calls made measurable differences, it could be a useful tool in the fight against isolation.
It's one of several potential solutions that will then be available to folks as they think about how to intervene, not just screen for and recognize that the issue exists.
Adam Hauser with Meals on Wheels says it's more important than ever for people to tackle this problem as a major public health issue. He says isolation can affect someone's physical health as well as their emotional health.
Loneliness and depression and feelings of isolation, in our view, are viruses just like COVID and can have just as devastating health impacts, particularly on seniors and older adults.
DelMed researchers are currently working to get the results of their study published as soon as possible so the program can be replicated elsewhere.
In Austin, I'm Ashley Lopez. You're on Texas Standard Time.
For some COVID-19 patients, a negative test does not mean they're done with the virus. It's called long-haul COVID, when symptoms like chronic fatigue, respiratory problems, and brain fog can persist for months after contracting the virus. Although doctors know more about long-haul COVID than when the pandemic started, there are still many questions about its effects. For more, we turn to Dr. Esther Melamed. She is an assistant neurology professor at UT Austin's Dell Medical School. Dr. Melamed, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We spoke last fall about these folks who experience symptoms from COVID-19 months after they first contract the virus. Do you have a better idea now about how prevalent this is?
So, David, there have been studies looking at patients at a couple of weeks, at 3 months, and now the most recent study has looked at patients at 6 months post-COVID. And it appears that this is still very much of a prevalent condition, even going out to 6 months for folks. Mm. And the main symptoms that are experienced include fatigue and headaches, pain. There are persistent neuropsychological symptoms, and we are still learning about this syndrome, but it certainly does appear that even out to 6 months at this point, folks are still experiencing symptoms.
And what separates those whose symptoms persist for so long versus everyone else, or those who seem to get over it in pretty short order?
It's a very interesting question, David. So comorbidities such as obesity and high blood pressure, diabetes, or mental health all seem to predispose patients to a higher risk of getting COVID, as well as to ongoing long-term symptoms. However, it is interesting that even patients who were asymptomatic or had mild disease during the acute COVID infection still continue to have these long-term post-COVID symptoms. And so it is not just the patients who were in the ICU and who had multi-organ damage to the heart, lungs, and the brain that can determine long-lasting symptoms. There's definitely something that we're still not completely understanding in terms of what other effects there may be on the body by the virus in those who may have had mild or even asymptomatic disease.
Well, we've been hearing so much of late about mutations of this virus. Is it possible there could be a particular strain to blame or something else entirely?
That's also a really good question. And with every new finding, there are 10 new questions that are raised. And
right.
Now that we have learned, we're learning about the different strains of the virus in Great Britain and in several states in the United States and several emerging in other countries. It is certainly the case that some of the strains may predispose to different symptoms. The other possibility that my research team, in collaboration with other immunologists and physicians at Dell Medical School, are studying is whether there is an emergence of autoimmune diseases post-COVID, and perhaps that may be one of the factors that could explain why people with mild or asymptomatic COVID may continue to experience symptoms post-COVID.
Do there seem to be any distinctions between groups of people when it comes to long-term effects of COVID?
Yes, so we're learning that men are predisposed to getting a more severe disease, but interestingly, women seem to be outnumbering men at a ratio of 4-1 in terms of presenting for long-term COVID symptoms. And it's unclear whether this is a true genetic difference or environmental difference, or it may be that women are seeking care more often than men are. Another question that we will, I'm sure, continue to learn about as we investigate post-COVID syndrome in the coming months.
Obviously, we're going to continue to keep an eye on that research at the Dell Medical School, UT Austin. That's where Dr. Esther Malamed is an assistant neurology professor. Dr. Malamed, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Time now to turn to your questions about COVID-19. We've been asking you to send in whatever inquiries you might have about the pandemic or the vaccine, and we're going to get some answers from Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard. Good to have you, sir.
It's great to be back, David.
All right, so this first question comes to us on Twitter from user Sam. Sam asks, I haven't had a primary care doctor in years. Since the vaccine is a two-part jab, will it be available at pharmacies like the flu shot, or will folks need to have a primary care physician to get the vaccine?
Well, Sam is correct that historically flu shots and other vaccinations have been administered in pharmacies under the authorization of that company's medical director without necessarily a medical home. So he should be able to do that under the COVID-19 as well.
You do have to, as I understand it, you do have to go back in for a second shot and make sure it's the Pfizer vaccine, not some other brand, right?
That is correct, and that might be a very difficult record-keeping process. So I can't tell you with certainty how that's going to be maintained.
This next question is from an anonymous listener who asks, I've heard the Pfizer shot is particularly painful because it has to be administered at such a low temperature. Are you aware that that's the case, Doctor? I believe I've heard that the vaccine has to be held at something like negative 70 degrees Celsius.
Well, the vaccine itself is always thawed to a liquid form before administration, so it will be above the freezing point. So the temperature at the time of the vaccination is probably not going to affect any pain or other problems at the site.
I see. Well, that is probably comforting for a lot of folks to know, people who think that it might be injected at a super cold temperature. That's not the case, it sounds like. Another question related to the temperature of that Pfizer vaccine, this one from Thomas Nugent, who asks, should we have more faith in the Moderna vaccine becoming more popular since it doesn't have to be stored at such a low temperature like the Pfizer vaccine? I mean, could that low temperature requirement affect efficacy and distribution as you see it, Dr. Campbell?
Well, I'm confident that our distribution system is going to deliver any vaccine to fairly remote areas without much problem. I understand that these vaccines can maintain their potency under refrigeration for several hours. So although it might be very difficult to have people that are very remote vaccinated, I know that that's feasible with these vaccines.
I was trying to think of another situation in the U.S., at least in recent memory, that might be a parallel when it comes to ramping up for the mass inoculation of Americans. I was thinking maybe polio, perhaps the polio vaccine back in the 1950s. Can you imagine any parallel? Just how big of a logistical issue is this going to be moving into January of 2021?
Well, I am old enough that I actually helped participate in the vaccine project with polio. I was a Boy Scout back in the wow. 60s when we were giving out sugar cubes with the Sabin oral vaccine. So it was a project that involved people coming into schoolhouses, to churches, to other places, and lining up for long periods of time to get their vaccination in oral form. So that was my first experience with a big vaccine campaign, and of course it has virtually wiped out polio in the world at this point. We're getting very close.
Dr. Campbell, one other quick question. I was thinking about the timeline here. It was about March, I recall, when the nation began to go on lockdown. Tell me, come March 2021, where do you think we're going to be with this vaccine and the pandemic at large in Texas?
Well, there will be hundreds of thousands of people safer in some respects because of being vaccinated by that time, particularly our highest risk individuals, the elderly and infirmed who are institutionalized, and of course our frontline workers. I don't think that March is likely to be safe for most of the population, however, that have not been vaccinated and would still need to do all of the common sense things we've been talked about, including social distancing and wearing of masks, until much later in 2021.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. He's been joining us regularly over the course of the pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask the doctor about virus or the vaccine, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again. Good to talk with you, sir.
So it's great to be of help.
And this has been your coronavirus update for Friday, February 12th, 2021. Stay tuned for the magazine Entertainment Weekly, followed by national news with USA Today at 2, and our local news broadcast with our papers in Odessa and Midland at 3. And then more news from the Wall Street Journal at 6. Finally, tonight at 7, as always on Fridays, we bring you some lighter news and funny readings from On the Lighter Side. That's tonight at 7. Thank you again for joining us, and have a great weekend. We will be back with our regular program. We will be back with our regular program at 1 o'clock Monday afternoon.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 10 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper single digits. Then tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the upper 30s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, I'm Allison Ramsey, and this is Health Magazine. Today, I'll begin reading from health.com. The first story is 5 Shower Mistakes That Can Wreck Your Skin. Skin saboteurs are lurking in your daily shower, by Lindsay Murray. Updated on February 9th, 2021. Each product we feature has been independently selected and reviewed by our editorial team. If you make a purchase using the links included, we may earn commission. You probably don't put too much thought into your daily shower. It's just something you do every day to get clean and, depending on your routine, wake up or wind down. But certain habits may actually be leaving you with dry, itchy skin, or even prone to a raging infection. Nix these sudsy saboteurs before you lather up next. Your water is too hot. Dry, itchy skin? Scalding showers might be to blame. If there's tons and tons of steam coming out, then that's a sign that your shower is too hot, says Melissa Piliang, MD, dermatologist at the Cleveland Clinic. In addition to drying out your skin, Dr. Piliang warns that hot showers can cause eczema to flare up. You don't have to give up steamy showers entirely. To get the same soothing effect, Dr. Piliang recommends letting the steam build up before you step under the water. First, turn on your shower as hot as you want it, she explains. Let it get nice and steamy and warm in there. And after it's all heated up, turn it down to a comfortable temperature and then get in. This way you can enjoy the heat without irritating your skin. You're using a harsh soap. You may love that squeaky clean feeling that comes from scouring your skin, but soaps with antibacterial agents or harsher detergents may be causing more harm than good. That squeaky sensation happens when all of the natural oils have been stripped from the skin. In contrast, when oils are present, they act as a lubricant so your hand will slide smoothly over the skin, says Dr. Piliang. Without that barrier, your skin is even more exposed to hot water, whipping winds, and other things that dry it out. What's more, triclosan, an antibacterial ingredient used in some soaps, has been linked to more serious health concerns. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, maintains that the ingredient is not toxic to humans, but studies in animals have suggested that triclosan may alter hormone levels. Other lab studies have linked the chemical to contributing to the development of antibiotic resistance. Dr. Piliang recommends skipping antibacterial soaps in the shower and looking for products that are fragrance-free and contain added moisturizer. Everyone's skin is different, so you may need to try a few different products to find the one that's right for you. You're scrubbing too much. Unless you're covered in grime from, say, working outside all day, the only places that need major soaping are your armpits and groin. Water does the job for everything else, even after a sweaty workout, explains Robin Chutkan, MD, the founder of the Digestive Center for Women in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and author of The Microbiome Solution, $16, Amazon.com. In addition to those natural oils, your skin is also crawling with good bacteria that are crucial for skin health. Scrubbing down from head to toe, even if you're using a milder soap, can still strip your skin of this beneficial bacteria that helps protect you from acne and eczema flare-ups, and, yep, dry skin. You're not cleaning your razor. Razors can collect bacteria from your skin and can then breed more germs while sitting in a damp, dark shower. That's why you must rinse it with scalding hot water before each use, says Sanford Veter, MD, of Lakes Urgent Care in Michigan. Skipping this step can open you up to infection, especially if you cut yourself, but even if you don't. When you use the razor, you can obviously nick yourself and give yourself a cut, but the razor is also going to make very microscopic tears in the skin that can be a portal of entry for bacteria or fungus, adds Dr. Piliang. You should replace your razor blade completely about once a week. If you use a dull blade, you are at a greater risk of cutting your skin and creating an entryway for that bacteria to come in, warns Dr. Veter. You're skipping gym shower etiquette. Your years of dorm living may be long behind you, but that doesn't mean you should abandon the practice of wearing flip-flops when you use a communal bathroom. Athlete's foot and warts can be picked up in public places, warns Dr. Piliang. Wearing shower shoes or flip-flops on your feet when you're in and out of the shower can help avoid these problems. That story was 5 Shower Mistakes That Can Wreck Your Skin, by Lindsay Murray, updated on February 9, 2021. The next story is, President Biden issues mask mandates for federal property and interstate travel. Here's what that means for you. Wearing masks isn't a partisan issue. It's a patriotic act that could save countless lives. By Claire Gillespie, posted on January 22, 2021. As he promised during the election, President Joe Biden wasted no time in taking action against the spread of COVID-19. One of his first orders of business in the White House was signing an executive order to mandate mask wearing in all federal buildings. The mandate took effect Tuesday, February 2nd. It's requiring, as I said all along, where I have authority, mandating masks be worn, social distancing be kept on federal property. Biden told reporters in the Oval Office, as reported by the New York Times. Under the mandate, face masks will be required on all federal property and by all federal employees and contractors. This applies to all federal buildings and land across the country, including federal courthouses, state capitals, national parks, and monuments. This means if you visit the Grand Canyon or the Statue of Liberty, you'll be required to mask up. Although Biden has no authority over state and local orders, he has urged them to enact their own mandates. While most states already have mask requirements in place, others, including Florida, Georgia, Oklahoma, and Tennessee, have chosen not to issue a statewide order. An executive order is basically a rule or order issued by the president to an executive department of the government, such as Health and Human Services or Transportation. The order has the force of law behind it, meaning you can be fined and/or imprisoned if you're found guilty of breaching its terms. Biden signed several executive orders in his first few days in office, including many reversals of actions taken by the Trump administration. The president stopped the U.S. withdrawal from the World Health Organization and appointed Dr. Anthony Fauci as head of the delegation to the WHO. Biden also created the position of COVID-19 response coordinator, who will report directly to the president and manage efforts to produce and distribute vaccines and vital medical equipment. Another of Biden's executive orders mandates masks for interstate travelers in the U.S. It requires several agencies to take action to require masks be worn in accordance with Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, guidelines, and applies to airports and planes, trains, ferries, intercity buses, and public transportation. While it's not yet clear how the requirements will be carried out, mandating masks for interstate travel was welcomed by many. What a difference leadership makes. We welcome President Biden's national approach to crushing the virus and lifting us out of this pandemic, said Sarah Nelson, the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, in a statement per CNN. She added that the mandate would provide much-needed backup for flight attendants and other aviation workers on the front lines. The Flight Attendants Union, AFA, first asked for a mask mandate on planes in April 2020, but the Trump administration refused. The then Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, said she felt the issue was better left to companies and employee unions to handle. Of course, the majority of travelers may have already been masking up for months. Airlines already require all passengers and crew members to wear masks, but a federal mandate adds weight to the rules already in place. Hopefully, this will help increase compliance and prevent the harassment of flight attendants trying to enforce their company's policies. In 2020, three major U.S. airlines, Delta, JetBlue, and United, added more than 1,200 passengers to their no-fly list for refusing to wear masks. As well as the mask mandate, Biden ordered that all travelers, including U.S. citizens, be required to show proof of a negative COVID-19 test taken within 72 hours of departure before entering the U.S. from abroad. and go into quarantine as soon as they arrive. This is in line with new CDC guidelines, which suggests a 7-day quarantine for arrivals from outside the U.S. The new mask mandates form part of Biden's 100 days masking challenge, which he launched before his inauguration. In an interview with CNN in December, he emphasized that the example must be set from the highest-ranking members of government to encourage others to do the same. Just 100 to mask, not forever. 100 days. And I think we'll see a significant reduction, he told the network's Joe Tapper. In one of the first tweets from his POTUS account, Biden said, "Wearing masks isn't a partisan issue. It's a patriotic act that can save countless lives. That's why I signed an executive order today issuing a mask mandate on federal property. It's time to mask up, America." And remember, this sentiment goes for everyone, even if you've had COVID-19 or have received both shots for the vaccine. The information in this story is accurate as of press time. However, as the situation surrounding COVID-19 continues to evolve, it's possible that some data have changed since publication. While Health is trying to keep our stories as up-to-date as possible, we also encourage readers to stay informed on news and recommendations for their own communities by using the CDC, WHO, and their local public health departments as resources. That story was, President Biden issues mask mandates for federal property and interstate travel. Here's What That Means for You, by Claire Gillespie, posted on January 22, 2021 on health.com. Switching to the January-February 2021 issue of Health Magazine, I'll read Love That Lasts. Every relationship changes over time. Knowing what to expect as you move from the honeymoon stage to deep-rooted devotion can help you reinforce your bond, by Ginny Graves. Amid all the recent whiplash-inducing developments in the world, pandemics, politics, one thing has remained stable. People continue to fall in love. Even with the outbreak of COVID-19, applications for marriage licenses actually surged in some parts of the country in February and March last year. Those newlyweds may be onto something. A number of surveys have found that married people are, by and large, happier than non-married people. But as any not-tires know, lifetime partnerships aren't simple, nor are they static. Our love relationships are always evolving, says Helen Fisher, PhD, senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of Anatomy of Love. We asked Fisher and other experts for advice on how to keep the happy and happily ever after as the anniversaries tick by. The season of sizzle. The first year or two of a relationship is marked by some heady factors. Daydreaming about your partner, seeing the best in him or her. Imaging studies show that the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, the brain region linked with fault finding, is abnormally quiet when you're falling in love. And having sex, sex, and more sex, an activity that promotes bonding. Genital stimulation triggers dopamine, a chemical in the brain's reward system that's associated with pleasure. An orgasm releases a flood of oxytocin and vasopressin, which promotes attachment, explains Fisher. That mix promotes this feeling of mildly obsessive love. Common pitfall. Now that your brain is hijacked by love chemicals, it's easy to miss red flags, says Lisa Marie Bobby, PhD, founder and clinical director of Growing Self-Counseling and Coaching in Denver. If you are eager to find a life partner, it can be tempting to ignore pings of concern about your partner, whether it's major differences around values or substance use issues, or mental health challenges, says Bobby. Thinking intentionally about what you want in a long-term partner and identifying the deal breakers can help you stay committed to your own needs, if not your partner. Helpful habits. Work on your communication skills, says Camille Lafleur, PhD, assistant professor of marriage and family therapy in the graduate program at Oklahoma Baptist University in Shawnee. Before you have a conversation, write down the key message you want to convey, she suggests, and try not to rush when you're talking. Share one or two thoughts at a time, then pause to see if your partner understands your true intention, and really listen to his or her response. Listening and being heard are fundamental for a happy partnership, says Lafleur. Deepening commitment. After a few years of couplehood, the early euphoria wanes a little, but in its place is something better, a sense of trust. You're revealing your secrets, hopes, and dreams, which builds intimacy, says Bobby. As you share every facet of your life, you come to understand each other more clearly and often care for each other more deeply. Common pitfall. When the love goggles come off, you may see things about your partner you don't like and vice versa. It's easy to become disenchanted because we think our soulmates are supposed to be perfect and relationships aren't supposed to have problems, says Lafleur. In reality, all relationships, like all humans, are a mixed bag of good and bad. Ask yourself, is this behavior or pattern something we could talk about and work through? And if so, how? Successfully working through problems deepens trust, says Lafleur. Helpful habit. Remind yourself of the things you adore and admire about your partner. In the beginning, you may have loved his or her spontaneity and creativity, but when you're at the stage where you need to clean out the garage, those traits can be frustrating, says Bobby. Fisher's research shows that couples in happy long-term relationships naturally minimize what they don't like about their partners and focus more on what they do. The intermittent storms. Every couple has conflicts, Fisher says, and they often strike during challenging times, like when work is demanding, financial stress is high, or you're raising kids. Regardless of what you're fighting about, at the core of every conflict are similar themes: feeling uncared for, disrespected, or devalued, says Bobby. Helping your partner understand those underlying reasons why you're upset can reduce the conflict. Be specific, suggests Amanda Pascuco, a marriage and family therapist and clinical sexologist in West Hartford, Connecticut. You can say, I'm feeling angry at you because you went out with your friends instead of helping me around the house. The story I'm telling myself about that is that you don't care. Common pitfall. Be careful not to show contempt. Eye rolling, ridicule, mockery, and sneering communicate a lack of respect, the foundation on which healthy relationships are built, says Ava Van Proyen, a marriage and family therapist in Santa Barbara, California. Research suggests contempt is the single most important predictor of divorce. That's how toxic it is. Helpful habits. Practice kindness. Surprise your partner with small gifts. Lend a hand with tasks. Or spend time together doing something he or she enjoys. Unexpected kindness triggers the brain's reward system, which is connected to romantic love, says Bianca Acevedo, PhD, a research associate in psychology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And say several nice things to your partner every day, adds Fisher. It lowers their cortisol and yours. Devotion. Here's some hopeful news. Researchers at Pennsylvania State University and Brigham Young University found that marital quality improves after 20 years. While shared activities dwindle in the first two decades, happy long-time couples start doing more fun stuff together again, like visiting friends and going on walks. Discord declines as well. Common pitfall. Boredom can settle in. After many years, couples are often comfortable, but they might also be bored or living largely separate lives, says Acevedo. To reconnect and reawaken excitement and passion, do new things together, whether it's taking a cooking class or dance class or going on a hiking trip. Novel experiences can rekindle that spark. Helpful habit. Remember to touch each other often. Hold hands under the dinner table. Walk arm in arm. Kiss, hug, snuggle on the couch while you're watching TV. Have sex, says Fisher. Maintaining physical connection is one of the best ways to sustain feelings of love and attachment. When to seek help. Just as you wouldn't wait till your appendix burst to go to the ER, you shouldn't wait till you're on the brink of divorce to go for counseling. Here are four common issues that can be managed in couples therapy. Your relationship is on autopilot. Work, eat, watch TV, sleep, repeat. We all get in ruts, but you don't want to stay in one. A therapist can help you find ways to prioritize your connection, says Lafleur. One of you has trust issues. We bring baggage from past relationships into our new ones, says Lafleur. Therapy can guide you as you work to understand those issues and build a stronger bond. Your sex life is struggling. Sex isn't just about sex. It's about feeling wanted and loved, and when it's not working, it can do damage, says Pascuco. Sex is a sensitive subject, so a lot of couples don't know how to talk about it without help, she adds. You keep having the same fight. Whether it's your drinking habits or your meddling in-laws, a complicated topic has become incendiary. Let a trained, neutral third party walk you through those tough conversations. That story was Love That Lasts by Ginny Graves. The next story is Smart Start. One of the easiest ways to get more veggies into your day is to begin at breakfast. Here, strands of butternut squash noodles are swirled into nests for nutrient-rich eggs. A clever combination that delivers protein, vitamins, fiber, and slow-burning carbs to power you through the morning. Recipe by Liz Mervosh. Butternut squash noodle nests. Active time 20 minutes. Total time 20 minutes. Serves 2. 2 tablespoons olive oil. 8 ounces spiralized butternut squash noodles. About 3 cups. 1/2 cup sliced scallions plus more for garnish. 1/2 teaspoon ground cumin. 1/4 teaspoon chipotle chili powder or smoked paprika. 2 large eggs. 1/4 teaspoon kosher salt. 6 tablespoons fresh pico de gallo. Lime wedges, sliced avocados, hot sauce, optional. 1. Heat oil in a large non-stick skillet over medium-high. Cook squash and scallions with cumin and chipotle chili powder, gently stirring occasionally, just until squash begins to soften, 2 to 3 minutes. Remove from heat. Using tongs, swirl squash, as you would spaghetti, to form 2 nests, each about 5 inches in diameter, with a 1.5-inch indentation in center. Return skillet with nest to medium-high heat. 2. Crack 1 egg into each nest. Cover skillet, reduce heat to low, and cook until egg whites are set, 4 to 5 minutes. Uncover skillet, remove from heat, and sprinkle eggs with salt. 3. Using a wide spatula, carefully transfer noodle nests to serving plates. Spoon pico de gallo evenly over eggs. Serve with lime wedges, avocados, and hot sauce if desired. Per serving, 259 calories, 19 grams fat, 3 grams saturated, 186 milligrams cholesterol, 3 grams fiber, 8 grams protein, 19 grams carb, 5 grams sugar, 0 grams added sugar, 451 milligrams sodium, 2 milligrams iron, 104 milligrams calcium. Vegetarian, gluten-free. That story was Smart Start, recipe by Liz Mervosh. The next story comes from the section The Share, Pap Quiz. January is Cervical Cancer Awareness Month.